97.9 FM, WCHL, and chapelboro.com present The Art of Potential, an illuminating talk show dedicated to getting your community educated, hired, and inspired. The Art of Potential combines real-world knowledge and expertise aimed at helping our community reach their full potential. Now, The Art of Potential on 97.9 FM, WCHL.
Hi, this is Kristen Heemstra with The Art of Potential Show. Thank you so much for joining us. We have an absolutely fascinating show in store for you today. We are talking with our own local celebrity, Sherry Castle. Welcome, Sherry.
Hi, how are you?
Well, I'm so glad I'm here with you today. So I'm fantastic. Now, if you aren't familiar with Sherry, let me give you a little bit of background. Sherry is a writer who cooks and a cook who writes. She is known for her ability to see the story behind Southern recipes and foodways. So what you're going to get in today's show is a little bit of cultural anthropology, which is what my degree is in, and a lot of her stories are about, as well as some really good discussions about food. She has worked on multiple cookbook projects. She's a solo author, and the new book she has out right now is Southern Living Community Cookbook. It is a book about celebrating food and fellowship in the American South. So we are going to be very pleased to hear about that. So, Sherry, let's talk about you. Community and food.
Mm-hmm.
Go.
No. Yeah, exactly. I have 10 minutes, right?
Right.
No, I think, you know, I do cook and I do write, but I'm really at the heart of it all, a storyteller.
Mm-hmm.
And for my whole life, the stories that fascinated me the most were that interaction and reflection of food and community. I came from a very specific community. I'm from the mountains of North Carolina. And so I had this sense early on that what we ate was because of who we were and where we were, and that it was
right.
different if we went to the beach or went to Charlotte
right.
or went to Washington, D.C. So for some reason, I've always had a sense of that place and play and all that. And so as I've gotten older and developed my career, I tend to, in some way, keep focusing on that topic because it never bores me. There's always something new to discover.
Well, there is. And with each dish and with each combination of flavors, you get another flavorful story.
You do.
Behind
you do.
It.
And, you know, food, there's a lot of homogeneity now. I mean, a lot of people said that
yes.
what's wrong with our food is it's the same everywhere. But there's still a lot of local flavor. And I mean that in every possible way. There are still certain dishes that, you know, if I go there, that's what I'm going to get to eat. Or if I go visit that person, this is what he or she's going to fix. You know, think about going home for the holidays, if you're a person who does, or if you host the holidays.
Right.
There are certain family traditions, community
yes.
traditions, and all that are still alive and quite well across this country.
Oh, there are. And I will give a personal example. My family hails from Michigan. And so I know that over the summer, my aunt made some amazing blueberry pies
mm-hmm.
apple pies
mm-hmm.
with Michigan
mm-hmm.
apple, and they'll be there at the Thanksgiving table. I can't wait to taste them.
That's exactly right. You know, and you know, Thanksgiving and some of those big ticket holidays are where these food memories and food practices really shine the brightest. And I always tell people that if you in a marriage or in a family or whatever it is, if there is a dish that is the very essence of Thanksgiving to that person, you better have it on the table. Even if it's not important to your family, you best not mess with people's Thanksgiving.
So when you talk about food, what you're really talking about is emotions.
Food and music seem to me the most evocative things.
Yeah.
And we all know that sensation of catching a whiff of an aroma that is instant time travel.
Yes.
It takes you back in ways that you don't understand to a different time and place. So, yes, food and emotion are very tightly intertwined. And there's actually human physiology behind that. The part of our brain that holds certain memories is near where our olfactory senses are perceived.
Yes.
And so there really is. There's brain behind this, not just heart and soul. There's brain also.
And I also think the person who's preparing the dish is probably also having an emotional experience in the preparation.
And they can. You know, it's not, sometimes cooking is a chore, like unloading
yes,
the dishwasher.
I know that. Yes.
But sometimes it is an act of love. And I don't think those things are mutually exclusive. I think it can vary. But there is nothing like sitting down, even if it is nothing other than somebody microwaving a meal from a position of love, that is a different experience than from an anonymous eating experience. And I think that that's a lot of why, again, to tie back to all this, you know, evocative, memory-driven sentiment and stuff like that. I mean, it doesn't have to be hokey, but it's very true. People say it doesn't taste like it used to. Well, there's probably, you know, lots of reasons for that.
Right.
The main thing is we miss who used to make it for us.
Uh-huh. It doesn't have that flavor that they gave it with whatever it was. Mm-hmm. Their love, their heavy-handed salt,
right?
Whatever.
Exactly.
So talk to me about food and community.
Well, I think there's lots of different ways to define community. I mean, it can be geography. It can be like-mindedness. Correct. It can be blood relatives. And all those things are equally valid.
Right.
But I think a community, when it comes to food, are people that are gathered in that instance for a common purpose. And that's both very specific and very vague. But for this thing, the Southern Living Community Cookbook, I mean, we know how many communities are in the South, or even within a county or a state or anything. But what I meant by that is, in this broadest thing, the community of people who have not only been readers of Southern Living for these last 48 years, but who took the time to mail in their own personal recipes. I say that all the years that people hand wrote a recipe, put it in an envelope, put their stamp on it, send it in. That was the social media of the day.
It was.
That's like Pinterest is now, or a blog or something.
Right.
They were sharing of themselves with the intention that people on the other end it would receive and read and perhaps use that recipe.
And give it a try. And I think, you know, how many communities we are in individually. You know, you're in your church community, which has its own, you know, Presbyterians tend to have certain things, Baptists tend to have, and Jewish people tend to have, Catholics, you know, so you have your own foods in that community. Then you have your junior league community, and in my case, I've worked at a school, so we also have that community, which has a lot of pizza involved in it. But those are all communities that we're all getting something from and contributing something to. And it's interesting because you may not bring the same dish to each.
That's right. That's right. But it's probably not random what you do bring.
Right.
You know, because you're bringing things that express who you need to be in that instance.
Right. How fascinating is that?
It is. It really is. Food stories, I'm telling you, I never get tired of them. And I'm blessed that people actually ask me to write them.
Well, okay. So let's hear one of your favorite food stories. I know you have like an encyclopedia's worth of them.
I really do. I think that for personally, some of the food stories is not unlike a lot of people of my generation. I could not wait to get out of my hometown.
Mm-hmm.
I was headed for the big time and the big town and all of that. And I turned my back on a lot of the practices and the food of my childhood. Even though I knew my grandmother was one of those storied cooks, I wasn't there to fry chicken. I was there to go have Peking duck or whatever
be.
And even what, you know, I was a professional writer before I was a professional cook, but when I did turn pro in the kitchen, I got myself to Italy with the goal of being the best Mediterranean, specifically Italian cook I could be. And in the early 2000s, I was in the central part of Italy in their hill country, not the mountains, but their hill country, which is a dead ringer for the foothills of the mountains of North Carolina. I mean, they grow the same crops. They have the same practices. It's a dead ringer. And what I realized is I had gone halfway around the globe to escape my past, to rediscover exactly what my past was. And it was an epiphany.
Yeah.
And it changed everything about the way I look at the world and writing. And food then. Because what I realized is that if a certain food has respect and cultural import in Italy, I bet it does where I'm from too. It got me off my high horse.
How funny is that? So what are some of the same crops? Because I think of Italy as olives. I do. Even though I know Spain grows the majority of the world's olives, I still think of Italy as olives.
Right.
Olive oil.
But in that part of Italy, there's a lot of apples and pumpkin and greens and pork. They make a thing like a biscuit. The crops, there's a lot of tobacco farms in that part of Italy. So when I would stand on the porch and see these blue mountains and tobacco fields and apples and stuff, I thought, I've gone home. Right. I've gone halfway around the world to go home. And it really did. It made me realize that I was very lucky to be from a place that's a place.
Well, we're going to take a break on that note. And when we come back, we're going to talk about cooking, whether it's a luxury, whether it's a meditation, kind of what it is in and of itself. You are listening to The Art of Potential Show with Kristen Heemstra. Please take a moment to check out our website at theartofpotential.com.
You're listening to The Art of Potential on 97.9 FM, WCHL.
Welcome back. This is Kristen Heemstra with The Art of Potential Show, and I am talking with Sherry Castle. We're talking about community and food, and Sherry has this amazing new cookbook out, the Southern Living Community Cookbook, and you can find it on Amazon. I've already been there myself and checked it out. But Sherry, let's talk for a moment. I want to talk about what cooking is, just the practice of it. I mean, it's almost... It's not yoga, but you have a yoga practice, and some people have a cooking practice. Like, it's part of your life you have to do every day. Well, you don't have to, I guess, but most people are engaged in every day. How do different people approach the cooking process itself?
Well, I think there's probably as many different ways to approach it as there are people trying to approach it.
Right. I mean, Or having to.
And I mean, let's be honest with it. You know, it's my passion, but it is a chore for lots of people. And I try to be respectful of that. I think that unfortunately, in trying to give people more options and ways to live, especially in the 70s and 80s, and in particular women, we somehow inadvertently made preparing food a task that should be beneath everyone. And I think that was an unintended consequence.
Right.
We don't all have to slave over a stove for hours, but to swing the pendulum in the opposite way and to abdicate all responsibility for what we eat and where it comes from and what that means, I think is equally invalid. So, you know, some days you're not meditating at all. It's not a practice. It's like, we have to eat something. And that's a reality I experience too.
Yep.
And then some days you realize this is a wonderful opportunity to do something simple that is a good thing for my family or for myself. I mean, I read just the other day an essay about a woman who realized that as a single person, she ate, but she never nourished herself, that she saved all of her effort and her mindfulness and so forth for when she had a guest over, and she realized that some days she should be the guest. And that doesn't mean putting out a palatial display.
Right.
Sometimes that's enjoying a really good apple on a fall day.
Right.
So, you know, the practice can be very meditative and mindful, or it can be, I've just got to get this done, but I hope it's not exclusively a chore and people don't give some thought to it, because it can be a very effective expression of love.
It can, and I'm just going to just tell you my experience as a working mother. It's all I can do to throw something in the microwave sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And someone complained to me the other day that they're having cereal for dinner, and I'm like, yeah, well, you know, you could have worse things.
That's right. And there are, you know, right, you're right.
There are those days.
There are. There are for me, too. I mean, clearly I have the skill set to do very elaborate things, but that doesn't mean I have the life set to enable those things. I have deadlines and practices, and I have a grocery budget, and I have to wash my own dishes and things like that. So I try to be more empathetic to the plight of what it is. It's also, you know, groceries are expensive. They don't have to be. But, you know, I think that I think it is interesting that people will find time for every soccer practice or find time for every dance recital or every after work meeting.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's incumbent upon us to find time to eat something together.
You're right, and that's a great way to look at it. That really is, because you're right. Families do stretch and bend and do whatever to do activities. Mm-hmm. It's a doing. Mm-hmm. But it's not necessarily the fellowship. And right. I think that's what food offers.
Food offers that, and it doesn't have to be all or nothing. You don't suddenly have to sit around and sing Kumbaya around right. the dinner table every night. You really don't. But to never do that right. is probably not the wisest thing we could do for our family configurations.
It's not. And no one's expecting you, though I do know some women who have a meal on the table every night. And I know some men who do, too. Mm-hmm. You know, that's mm-hmm. that is one of the ways that I think societies have changed.
And I think that if we were more gentle to ourselves, I think sometimes we get out of the habit of ever eating at home, whether that's heating up something or preparing it or whatever it might be. Sometimes that's picking up a chicken and making our own salad or what right. it, you know, whatever it is. Right. I think that we have made it intimidating to the point people's like, well, I can't do all of it, so I'm not going to do any of it.
I'm going to mm-hmm. give up now and go watch TV.
Exactly.
Iron Chef is mm-hmm. clearly going to be.
And, you know, speaking of Iron Chef, that is, you know, on the one hand, all of the proliferation of food television has made people more interesting.
Yes.
On the other hand, it has made actual cooking more intimidating. It's all about competition
yes.
and slaying and conquering and prevailing and time management. I mean, you know, if we were to apply that to any other aspect of our life, we'd all be afraid to get up and brush our teeth in the morning. You know, so I really think that that competition of I will prevail is not right. doing our home cooking a bit of favor.
Well, no, because you can't go and do one of the Iron Chef recipes.
No, it's
not
exactly.
that you would want to.
Right.
But, you know, some of them look really good.
But, you know, I think that, you know, my daughter is a sophomore in college now, and I think that I was the kind of parent, you know, I wanted her to have a few essential life skills.
Yes.
Here's how you write a check. Here's how you.
Thank you.
You know, here's
thank
how you,
you
get
thank
a.
Thank you.
You know, here's how you get.
You
you're supposed to get
your
oil changed.
Right.
You're supposed
right.
to send. Sending somebody off with the ability to cook spaghetti is yeah. a life skill.
Yes, it is.
And I just think that that's part of the whole package of getting yourself ready for life. If you, I think people also think that they have to be able to cook everything.
Correct.
No, if you can do a few things, you have the skills to get a few things on the table.
And if you know one good appetizer, you can mm-hmm. make it for everybody,
that's
for
right.
all the parties you go to.
Yeah. And in my cooking teaching, which I still do, I try to show people you know more than you think you know. If you know how to do this, you actually also know how to do this and this and this and this because it's the same thing. So you don't have to be able to do, like I always think of it as software. I use, you know, a word processing program.
Yep.
I don't have to install new software every time I write an email. I know how that works.
Yep.
Cooking's a lot that way, too. Once you know how the basics work, you really can do most of everything you intend to do.
All right. So let's say that I were in your cooking class and I was a young person about to leave for school.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What would you tell me are some basic things I need to know?
Well, I would say if you're going to use a recipe, consider the source. If you do have an online thing or
yeah.
whatever, and you've had consistent luck with them, going back to that is wise. There's everything and nothing on the internet. I mean, you can Google any recipe, but there's no vetting or discerning between what's reliable and what's not.
Right.
So when I go places, I drive the same roads because I know how that works.
Right.
So if you have a good source for recipes, do that. And then I would say, educate yourself on very basic vocabulary. What does it mean to boil or steam or microwave or bake or roast? That's going to be true. If you know what bake means on one cupcake recipe, you understand what bake means in all of them. So I'd say just a rudimentary vocabulary. And don't be afraid to try different things. I mean, if you can cook spaghetti, you can cook penne. If you can cook penne, you can cook, you know, seashells or something.
Right.
You're not having to change it. If you know how to make a spinach salad, you know how to make an arugula salad.
Right.
If you can cut up an apple, you can cut up a pear. And I don't mean to be, you know, oversimple,
yeah.
but there's so much
right.
more you down it. And if you don't know how to cut up those things, figure out who does. Fill in the gaps for what's beyond your thing. So if you're, you know, what I mentioned earlier, just in passing, a rotisserie chicken.
Right.
If you know how to make a great salad for yourself, then buy the chicken or buy the pie. If you know how to make a great pot of soup, buy the baguette. capitalize on what you are comfortable with and give yourself a break and purchase the rest.
Reminds me, Sandra Lee, sure her semi-homemade, that was, you know, kind of a way of being like, okay, I'm, you know, I'm not failing at this mother thing. I can buy what I don't know and throw some ingredients in. So I think that's really good advice, not just for the young people going off to college, but also for the busy working parents. So it has a little bit of influence of what you want.
It really is. And the busy working, I mean, it is. It's pervasive. We're all too busy.
Right.
We're all too busy. So you don't have to cook every night. Just cook some nights.
All right. We're going to take a break, and then we're going to talk about why you should be risking. Risky in the kitchen. You are listening to The Art of Potential Show with Kristen Heemstra. Please take a moment and check out our Facebook page.
You're listening to The Art of Potential on 97.9 FM, WCHL.
Welcome back. This is Kristen Heemstra, and I am talking with our Chapel Hill gem, Sherry Castle. Sherry is the author of many cookbooks, most recently the Southern Living Community Cookbook, where we are celebrating food and fellowship in the American South. So, Sherry, there are some very interesting recipes in your cookbook and just out there in general. I was listening to an interview you did on chocolate gravy. And it struck me that, you know, I'm not that risky in the kitchen, but somehow somebody had to come up with these recipes. What is your take on taking risks in the kitchen?
I think you have to take some risks because that's how you learn what works and what doesn't. And both of those things are equally useful. If you know, man, this works every time I make it, that's a keeper. And if you're like, man, this sucks every time I make it, then maybe that should be one that goes. But and I think also the more you take risk and you learn that certain foods go together, it's like, boy, soy sauce is good in this, or basil and tomatoes are always good, or this cheese melts better than that cheese. You're adding to your canon of things you don't have to figure out from scratch every single time. And sometimes, you know, there's happy accidents. You realize, gosh, that was really a good idea. And then you keep that. I do say that if people do, I want people to be creative and spontaneous, but if something is a great success, jot that down, because you think you're going to remember, but we all know, you know, a week of carpool later, it's like, I don't even know what it was I made, much less
that. Was it dirt?
Right. But, you know, risking is how, and also most culinary risks are actually a very safe risk. We're not all buying beef tenderloin every night. We're not paying $125. Right. We may have a pound of ground beef, or we may have, you know, a new vegetable we've never had before. For the most part, those are pretty safe risks. And so what's the worst that happens? The worst that happens is you order pizza or something like that. You throw it out. And it's really, how often, I mean, I think we all tend to be a little self-deprecating about our cooking because we've set up some sort of a goal that may or may not be valid. But really, what is about the worst thing that happens?
Right.
You know, it's usually edible
fire,
in some way.
Yeah, right.
And I have disasters. I mean, when I do, they're really catastrophic. I had one for
Please
a magazine. Yeah, I had one for a magazine article where something rose and bubbled more than I anticipated, and my oven was a holy mess. So, I mean, it happens to all of us, but you know what? I now know what that happened, and I won't do that again. Yeah, and so I just think that, you know, risk is actually can be fun. If your kids are involved, it's something to laugh about. But that's how you know what works. That's how you know this. I've got this.
So one of the risks I think people are intimidated to take is to invite others over to share a meal with them because they're afraid that their cooking isn't going to be good enough.
And I get that a lot, but I get it on the other side. I absolutely understand why so many of my friends, not my closest friends, but my acquaintances say, I would never have you over to dinner. I'd be afraid. I understand, but also they're there to see you and to have a good time and to be relaxed. And if the way that you are able to do that is, like I was saying earlier, buy some things, make a few things.
Lots of wine.
Yeah. Exactly. Remember, they are there to see you. They are not going to judge you. And if they do judge you, just don't have them back.
Right.
You know? But it really is. I mean, when I think about my best evenings with friends, the food is part of it, but it's never the sum total of it. You're playing cards, or you're talking, or you watch a video, or you go walk on the beach, or whatever it might be. It's a sum total. And most people are, most of us are just trying to get by.
Right.
And are a lot more generous of spirit to our friends than we think.
And we are to them, too. Mm-hmm. It's interesting because we are always generous to other people.
Right.
Whereas they wouldn't be to ourselves. And I'll tell you, I actually had that thought when I got married. I thought, no one's going to remember the food and no one's going to remember the cake unless they're both really bad.
Mm-hmm. So. And what they would remember even more than that is... Right. If you had worked so hard on the food and the cake that you were a mess, that you were a hot mess, no one has fun at an event where the host and hostess look like they need to lay on the floor and breathe in a bag. So just, you know, have appropriate...
That is so true, Sherry. No, that is so true.
Have appropriate expectations. Something I do, this is a real life story for me. I love to prepare food for people, but I'm not a very good decorator. I'm not good, even though I own the beautiful dishes, I always say I can either cook or I can vacuum, but I cannot do both on the same day. But I have friends who are less confident in their cooking, but set beautiful tables. We have a thing, and I say, if you'll set the table, I'll bring the supper. So team up with people. Team up with people. Or ask, if you're at Overload and somebody says, what can I bring? Tell them, could you pick up a cake, or could you bring a bottle of wine or a bottle of cheer wine or whatever it is?
Whatever it is.
You know, because I think if someone asked me, I would say, of course I will. They're just as likely to say, of course I will.
And to mean it, it gives them a means of contributing, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. it adds value, mm-hmm. too. And we all like to feel valuable. Mm-hmm. So.
And I have gotten a little more like, you know, if I have a friend who's maybe been under the weather, or there's a new baby, or this, that, and the other, I'm a lot more, I'm like, this is what I'm thinking of bringing. Does this work for you? And sometimes I'll say, you know, you didn't know this, but actually my kid is vegetarian right now, or my child doesn't eat peanuts or something like that. I'm just very forthright, and I do things that are simple. I don't take foods that are burdensome on them.
Right.
You know, and I think it really is the spirit. We can't combat the food of spirit.
Yeah.
I think that if somebody, it doesn't matter what they serve me, if they're there with a spirit of hospitality and friendship, I'm going to have a really good time, and so will your guests.
And I love that. I do think that food can be a way of touching the soul, and that it's just a gift that you can give of your time, mm-hmm. and of your energy, mm-hmm. and it's nourishing, mm-hmm. to your point. Mm-hmm. Very much.
And, absolutely. I wrote an essay for a magazine one time about what it's like when somebody brings food to a funeral. It is not what you are taking. It's the fact that you paused your life long enough to take them anything.
Yes. Now, and I remember some Midwestern funerals with Jell-O with peas and mm-hmm. carrots in it, mm-hmm. that somebody brought as mm-hmm. a loving gesture.
Mm-hmm. And I bet you there was some, and it was, and that's the power of that.
Yeah.
It may be an unusual food, but that loving gesture.
Yeah.
I also bet there was somebody that said, I have not had this since I was a kid.
Right.
Boy, I got to have a bite of that.
Absolutely, and it was one of the deceased's favorite dishes.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so isn't that even more, you know, redoubling what the point of the whole thing was?
Yep.
And, you know, we all have our foods that we like to poke fun at, and some of them were truly dreadful, but that doesn't mean we don't have some sentiment about it.
Oh, right. No, we don't. I agree with her. We do. We have mm-hmm. emotions around that.
Mm-hmm.
And forever, peas and carrots and Jell-O will be Midwestern mm-hmm. to me.
Yes, absolutely.
That is definitely mm-hmm. one of the things. And just as a more technical side, I know not everybody has the same growing season. So mm-hmm. I'm curious, you know, you've got the Midwest, the South, Central Italy, Central North Carolina. Mm-hmm. What are some ways that people have preserved foods? Because it also seems like food preservation was also a community time together.
It was. And of course, back in the day, and those days weren't that long ago, you had to preserve it because there were opportunities to purchase things otherwise.
Right.
If you grew it in the summer, you had to figure out how you could not only eat it then, but how were you going to eat it in the middle of the winter.
Right.
And so now we don't have that problem quite so much, but we may be choosing to preserve food because the surest way to know what's in it is to process it yourself, make it yourself. And, you know, everybody kind of got on a canning bandwagon, and I think that we maybe made that sounded harder than it was. I think we all have visions of our grandmothers putting up 120 quarts of creamed corn in the summer. You don't realize that 2 pints is an option too. So when I've been asked to speak on that lately, I've been reminding people of how easy it is to freeze certain foods. You know, that's a modern thing, but you know, people used to dry foods and they used to can. And where I'm from up in the mountains, there was a huge history of burying food in the ground because the ground is an insulator.
Yes, it is.
You know, so all of those things we don't, but it doesn't have to, you don't have to go full bore. You don't have to process your own hogs in the fall. But it is very plausible that if you go to the farmer's market and it's the end of the green bean season or the butter bean season, to freeze 2 or 3 pints of those in our own freezer is really within everyone's space and time and skill set. It requires freezer bags. You know, that's all.
And we can all do that.
And we can all Let's be honest. We really can. And, you know, I think that the canning phenomenon is great. It has gotten people interested in a skill set that was about to become extinct or certainly obsolete. I just still remind people, you don't have to put up 20 quarts if your kitchen and your family and your time allow to make 2 pints. Do what you can.
All right. So I don't know much about canning, but I think let's just talk about canning tomatoes. You've got beautiful summer, delicious tomatoes. How would you can those?
Well, one of the easiest things to do would be to just cook them. Go ahead and cook them and can them or freeze them. But there is out in the world a thing called the Ball Canning Blue Book. And and that's what I go to. It's online. It can be purchased at like Walmart or Target,
smart
anything for $2 or $3. And if you do what they tell you to do, you will not get food poisoning. You
fantastic,
won't.
I believe
that. And it's easy. And it tells you the little things like how much room to leave at the top of the jar. How long do I cook this? Do I have to heat seal the jars? Can I just stick it in the fridge? So, you know, there, for all of this, it is an art form for which there's science behind it. And it's very straightforward. And if you do what it says, if it says boil this 4 minutes, I set my timer and boil it 4 minutes. And it will be safe and your results will be excellent.
Okay.
And, it, you know, we all are rewarded by excellent results.
Yes, we are. We like that.
Yes.
Good system in place.
Yep.
All right. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we are going to delve into this Southern Living Community Cookbook. You are listening to The Art of Potential Show with Kristen Heemstra. Please take a moment and check out our website. You can hear this interview there, theartofpotential.com.
You're listening to The Art of Potential on 97.9 FM. WCHL.
Welcome back. This is the Art of Potential Show with Kristen Heemstra, and I have the privilege of interviewing Sherry Castle right now. Sherry is one of our local legends. She has written most recently the Southern Living Community Cookbook, and it is a book about celebrating food and fellowship in the American South. So, Sherry, beautiful book. Tell us exactly when this comes out. When can our listeners go and buy it?
The official release date is October 14th. It's available through pre-order from any online retailer, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, whatever they might be. And as of the 14th, it'll be available in any bookstore. You know, if you have a local independent that you can walk to or whatever your outlet for purchasing books is, it will be available on October 14th nationwide.
All right, so I have to tell you, even if you are not a cookbook person, I want you to go and get this book because it is gorgeous inside. And it tells, it reminds me of a National Geographic issue where, you know, the stories tell a picture and the recipes tell a picture. So what inspired you to think of this book?
Well, it was a combination of things. Southern Living, I did this with and for Southern Living Magazine, as the title would imply, and they had a notion that they wanted to do something about community cookbooks. And they, through past work I'd done for them, knew I had a sense of story.
Yes.
And so we came together with this, and what I proposed to them and what we ultimately did is I went through their 48 years of magazines. They've been in,
congratulations. Yeah. That must have been quite an
endeavor. It was unbelievable. We honestly believe I'm the only person who has ever read every issue they've put out. And that was at least 45,000 recipes. And then not all had been contributed by readers. So I went down to those. And then I tried to pick out, there's about 220 in here, of recipes that really conveyed who is this community of Southern Living readers. Mm-hmm. And is this something I believe somebody's going to make now? I didn't want to put anything that was so obsolete or that right. simply couldn't be made because the ingredients aren't available anymore. I wanted to put in a few curious things, but no freak show things.
Right.
You know, things that had been very popular with both submitted by readers and used by readers over the years. But at the heart, I wanted it to feel in spirit like those spiral bound books yeah. that we all know in love, you know, that are put out by the volunteer fire department and the yeah. Sunday school class and the PTA and all that. You know, there are people that never owned any other cookbooks other than those community books. So even though we didn't literally spiral bind it, that was the spirit. When I kept saying, okay, now how do I want this to go? I went back to that as my star in the East.
Well, and I'll tell you, having lived in Alabama for a while, my mom had the Cotton Country Cookbook. I'll never forget the yellow in the, you know, the cover. And that thing was tattered. It was spilled on. There were handwritten notes on it. It was dog-eared. Pages were stuck in there of other recipes. Mm-hmm. You know, it became kind of her cooking canon, if you will.
Right, right. And I love that. And I think that image is going to be familiar to so many people, that yeah. what was that book where you said, you know, they would clip things off the back of something or out of the newsletter, out of the newspaper, whatever it was, and make that their collection box. The women in my family had their equivalents to that. And the reason was, is they knew those recipes. Even if they didn't work, they trusted the source. They knew it had come from a place that they trusted the source and they trusted the spirit of it. And if it didn't work quite right, or if your family or your whatever had a variation, you wrote it down. So to come across one of those from our past is not only insight into the community, mm-hmm. but into your own household, because these women, I'm sure there were men too, but mainly women, wrote in the margins. It was like a little flash of autobiography.
It was. And a taste and a picture of that family and even the recipes that weren't used.
Exactly. Exactly. And isn't that just as insightful in many ways, the things that weren't? But, you know, I always say, if you can tell when a cookbook has been loved, that if you were to, heaven forbid, drop it in a pot of water, it'd make soup because yeah. there's so much on it. Right. And that's true. And, I know that sometimes, you know, we've been faced with, like, you know, cleaning out a family member's house or maybe helping a parent downsize. Yeah. When you come across those, you have a real treasure.
You do, and you don't realize it until after or when you're holding it in your hand. Mm-hmm. I can agree with that. So were most of these community cookbooks, were they done as fundraisers? What is the genesis of them?
You've hit on the perfect word. Almost all of them were fundraisers. The very first community cookbook was done as an effort to raise money for a Civil War veteran hospital. And the interesting thing was they started in the late 1800s, and it was a way for women to have a benign but effective way to come together, raise money, orchestrate how it was spent, and support causes even though they couldn't vote or hold board seats or this, that, and the other. It was a community activism thing in a very benign and accepted way. But beyond that, it was also an effective fundraiser. So some of these, you know, the cookbooks that we're talking about, some of the older ones have sold millions of copies, something no contemporary cookbook will ever do, and have put millions of dollars back into their community. They're very effective fundraisers.
And part of that, I would think, is because a lot of times your recipe is in there. So it's,
exactly.
It's personal.
It's personal. It was a point of pride. How many women was that the only time they ever saw their name printed in anything? Yep. It might have been as Mrs. So-and-so and so-and-so, but it was still their name. And I know if I were to come across, well, I did literally come across a community cookbook in a little junk shop, antique shop, whatever you call it, in the county where I grew up. Yeah. And my grandmother and her sisters and sisters-in-law, their names were in there. Yeah. And it made me wobbly in the knees with pride. It's like, look at that.
And then you're also connected because, again, food is very intimate. So if I'm making the same thing you're making, mm-hmm. we now have a shared experience and a connection, even though we're in totally different areas.
Totally different areas. And it is probably the most reliable form of repeatable history we can get.
Yeah.
Now, granted, our ingredients may be a little bit different. Yeah. Can sizes change?
What ingredients did you notice were different from the Civil War till now? I mean,
oh, lots of things. So nothing was packaged back then. Right. And in vetting the recipes for this book, I had to eliminate things where literally the ingredients were no longer available. Here's one that comes to mind. There was this stuff called Dream Whip. It was essentially powdered milk that you could add water and whip and make a whipped topping.
Oh, wow.
And it's what people did when they stopped whipping cream and before they could buy Cool Whip. There was this intermediary thing where it was reconstituted whipped and chilled powder called Dream Whip. And apparently we relied on the stuff heavily for about 20 years. Another thing that's interesting in doing this, you know, archaeology, these old recipes, is how many of us have recipes that said, take a can of this and a box of that and a packet of that. Well, if the product still exists, the ingredients are different, but mainly the can size is different.
Oh, yes. But you're right. Everything has changed in size.
Mm-hmm.
So you're right.
So sometimes, you know, it takes a little bit of, you know, recreating it and so forth. And I find that, you know, I found that challenging. But you could definitely tell the influence of product introduction and marketing. You can tell exactly when did slow cookers, crock pots hit the scene. When were we all suddenly terrified of fat in all forms but couldn't eat enough sugar? When did we decide this, that, and the other was either good for us or bad for us or should be celebrated or vilified? All that's reflected in community cookbooks.
Absolutely.
It's a time capsule.
Absolutely. Wow. Fascinating. All right, Sherry. So it's our last minute here. People can get your book, Southern Living Community Cookbook online, and then tell us about your website.
My website is sherrycastle.com, and that's SHERICASTLE. And if anyone is local and would like to come to a book signing or a sampling or one of the actually great array of things, that's how they can find. My full schedule is on sherrycastle.com.
And she is packed. I will tell you that. Getting her on the show was a, you know, I'm trying to jump in here. And I will also have links on it at theartofpotential.com so you can find out more information there. Thank you for listening. This has been The Art of Potential Show with Kristen Heemstra.